a poem by Mary Oliver. Over the local stations, one by one, announcers list disasters like dark poems that always happen in the skull of winter. But once again, the storm has passed us by. Lovely and moderate, the snow lies down while shouting children hurry back to play, and scarved and smiling citizens once more sweep down their easy paths of pride and welcome. What else might we do? Let us be truthful. Two counties north, the storm has taken lives. Two counties north to us is far away. A land of trees, a wing upon a map, a wild place never visited. So we forget with ease each far mortality. Peacefully from our frozen yards, we watch our children running on the mild white hills. This is the landscape that we understand. And till the principle of things take root, how shall examples move us from our calm? I do not say it is not a fault. I only say, except as we have loved, all news arrives as from a distant land. Tonight I want to speak on wholeness and healing through generosity. And this time of year for me, I hope it is for you, is a kind of reflective time, not only in the Northwest where it turns dark at 4:30 and rainy, but it's that time of year alone feels kind of a time to turn inward. But holiday season, from really Halloween through the first of the year, it also feels like a time of deep reflection and sort of a summation. I was thinking about that tonight because a neighbor who is in her 80s has had this bitter relationship with another neighbor over the last 50 years. They've lived side by side together a few houses away from us, and they're always trying to position themselves in our judgment, elevate themselves in our judgment against the other person. And it's been going on for 50 years, and I just thought, what's the summation of all of this? What have you got out of it? What's the 80X number of years? When you look at yourself, what have you become through all of this? And when I look at the culture, there's a deepening sadness in me. I was seeing the news tonight where there was a list of video games that are so violent, and they showed one of them. It was a gang, an inner-city gang, going through the city and shooting people at free will. And you could select who you wanted to shoot driving your car. And the deep abrasive injustice and insensitivity that such games play, they are not innocent. They are not without impact. When I was an undergraduate student, I did a study where we showed to preschool children violent cartoons and cartoons that had no violence. And then we had a scale of that we recorded the aggressive behavior after each set of kids watched each set of cartoons. And we did this over a number of months, and experientially it showed a significant rise in aggressive behavior, of course, with those kids who watched the cartoons, the aggressive cartoons. And there have been many studies since then that have indicated similar results, but you can begin to see it now. You know, it begins to, as I have lived 58 years, I have begun to see the changes where in sporting arena, the sports, where players are going into the audiences and creating havoc. In the political arena, I have never seen such a divisive campaign or a sense of them and us embitterment, even through this prolonged gubernatorial race. And it's time to take stock here. It's time to look to see whether we're a part of all of this divisiveness or whether we can counter with something that could genuinely be healing. And my hope that Thanksgiving for us is a time to pause reflectively and ask those questions. It's also a time to appreciate. It's appreciating our affluence, appreciating the privileged existence that we have. No question about it. And it's a call for responding from that appreciation. When we respond from appreciation, then the actions that are generated from that are universally received as helpful, as generous. And it's around that sense of generosity, I think. If there's a word for me that holds a key relationship towards healing and non-division, that holds a view merely by holding the word, there are few words that we have that hold such a universal appeal and inclusiveness as generosity. It's a very special word. But it's only special when we first recognize the privileged position that we're in, honoring that. Yes, it's we, all of us, no matter what our situation. But then not denying the less privileged. And because we can very quickly become numb to those who are less fortunate. And then we lose our generosity. Generosity isn't from affluence to affluence. It's always from inclusiveness. And so we can only really develop a generous heart when we are aware of the pain of those who are less fortunate. And I want to offer common sense practices, nothing special, common sense practices that allow us to come into that word again and again, to renew it in ourselves, to, especially during this time in our country's history and also this particular time after our political divisiveness. Real generosity. And for instance, I realized that after I'd come back from India, having seen real poverty, abject poverty, a hunger beyond measure. And I thought to myself, I want to remember this. And I know as soon as I land back in the States, it'll all become a time-lagged blur. And I won't remember any of it. So I said, okay, I'm going to fast one day a week. And I'm not fasting for health reasons or to be a good yogi. I'm fasting to remember the hungry. I'm fasting to have some connection with the less fortunate. And I did that for 2.5 years. So it's just once in a while, to put ourselves into the position of real desperation. We can do it from pity when we look out upon the homeless and we're tucked into our warm houses. That leveling position is really sympathetic, but it's not connected. It's not connected. It's distant. It's not related to. It's not related to. And I'm interested in the relationship of it, not just knowing about it, but really feeling it in my heart, the pain of it. And any of these tricks that I'll mention tonight, and I'll mention several, are only as good as our willingness to renew our relationship again and again, because we can very easily numb over to whatever alarm clocks we set up for ourselves, especially along this one, because the mind's just waiting not to have to feel disadvantaged, not have to feel the pain. You see, accessing, until the things take root, until the truth takes root, what shall stir us from our calm? I read that poem very deliberately because it moves me so much that here we are in the middle of a war of our own creation, and we aren't even including the slaughter of those innocent peoples in which country we have invaded. The numbers come back in terms of American casualties, not Iraqis. And if they did, who cares, right? Who cares? And if we can begin to see the insensitivity of that view and the insulation that we are creating, we can perhaps have some inkling of the absolute anger that other cultures hold for this one. And then the beginning of understanding might arise. Until the truth, the principle of things take root, takes root. That's what we're doing here. We're trying to allow the principles to take root in us. The principles of life, the truths of life, the facts. Well, two counties north, some people lost their lives. So I do little, you know, little things, little suggestions. I find pictures sometimes of people who are in desperate, like Sudanese, starving, and I put them on the refrigerator. So that when I open the refrigerator towards my abundance, I have to hit something there. I have to see something. I'm afraid the Dharma practice only has one way, and that's the path of the heart. If it were different, if I could just give you an intellectual journey into emptiness, well, you can take it, but you would be a creature I wouldn't want to know. And there are many people who journey that way, because the principle of thing has not taken root. And so just little things that we can do during this time to stir us back, both in terms of our privilege and honoring that, not being shameful of that, but for whatever reason, this is the turn of the wheel of our karmic, of our karma, so that we are we can be healthy, relatively so. We can eat well, relatively so. We can be warm at night. Okay, great. Not to begrudge that. But not to lose sight of the extension of the populations. And so I thought, okay, as an ongoing practice, again, just a suggestion, just an ongoing practice. I every time I see somebody selling Real Change, that newspaper that I know has a legitimate, is trying legitimately to come out of their poverty, not just use the poverty, not just use the money for to buy alcohol or whatever. I just a dollar, right? Just a dollar, just automatically. Just as a training, just to connect, just to, because the impulse of generosity comes to us many times a day, but how often do we act upon it? How often do we turn away from that impulse? So a a practice for you might be that this coming week, I think it's part of the homework, every time you have the impulse, you act on it. Don't question it. I'm not talking about giving your house away. I'm talking about, you know, just the impulse. Okay, I want to give something to that person. The enormous joy one feels. When you receive a present, you get happy. One can obtain happiness, which is a very transitory state, from receiving gifts. Well, I'm just the sweater I always wanted. But if you want to transcend happiness to joy, that can only happen through giving. Why? Because we're relinquishing. We're giving up rather than adding to. And with that giving up, the mind springs forth in lightness and in being unburdened in true connection. In true connection. Another thing that I just do, I'm just offering these things, is that every time I turn on my computer, no matter how much of a rush I'm in, which is a key, I go to the hunger site. And the hunger site has this thing where you click on, there's like 5 or 6 different tabs, hunger and rainforest site and literacy site and breast cancer site and children's health site, et cetera, et cetera. And you push on it and it goes into a page of advertisements. But just clicking on it, the very click, for no money, nothing, only your time, then the sponsors of that page, the advertisers, give money to that site just for you pressing. So, and if you do it quick enough, I don't have a DSL line, you can do it so that you don't have to see the advertisements, and you can go to the next tab. So you click and tab, and you can get through the whole thing in no time, and you don't have to see a single ad. The hunger site. Why not? Why not? Why not begin when you turn on the computer, the very mechanism, the mechanics? Why not? Why not start it that way? Why not start your day that way? But remember this, that no generosity, we cannot build the muscle of generosity in abstention. We have to bring awareness to the problem. We have to see the pain. We have to feel the pain for the heart to be engaged. See, this is the trick. So when you go to the hunger site, do some metta for the hungry. Feel the connection between clicking and hunger. Oh, may all beings be free of hunger. Click. May all children have adequate health care. Click. The Buddha said, if you knew what I knew about generosity, you wouldn't let a single meal go by without giving some away. The power of it. The power of it. And then my favorite Christian presentation of Christ is where he's standing, just holding his hands out. All come. Everybody come. No one excluded. Everyone. Everyone come. The ultimate generosity. I remember that when I was a monk in Thailand, I would be sitting and walking in my little hut, and I would venture up to the front of the monastery, and I'd see the Ajahn Buddhadasa. And all day long, people would just come. Busloads would come. People would pour in, gather around all day long. All day long until he had to go to bed. 16 hours a day, he'd just sit in his chair and people would come. And I thought, wow, what an enormous statement of this, of the hands wide open. Everybody come. Everybody come. And you begin to see, you know, in Buddhist countries that have lived with this tradition for eons, they have developed a culture that instills generosity and morality as the foundation on which the Buddhism is practiced and insight arises. And what we are trying, we're trying to, you know, forget all that stuff. Let's just get to the insight, right? The Western approach is to go to McDonald's. It's the hard, you know, which is hard. It's hard to be, to put into action. We just want the wisdom. You know, give me the Big Mac. Don't forget all the other frails. I just want it. So I'll just sit. I'll just, like I did, I'll just sit year after year. What about the, you see, it just doesn't happen that way. This is a cellular change. This is a change of our body-mind integration in action. Not just the gleaned wisdom from practice and from observation, but the integration of that observation into the cells of our body so that to receive and to give and to move out and to raise one's hands in inclusion. That's the integration. That's where this thing is going. That's where this thing is going. And as soon as we make a move towards generosity, expect the mind, because that's the heart and its great yearning. It will set an intention to be generous, to look for opportunities to give, to look for opportunities to be inclusive. But don't expect the mind to roll over. The mind comes back at you with your selfishness. It will stamp itself with the selfishness that we have lived with. And so in order to be generous, in order to move in that way, we have to expect that what is going to come up for us is our objections to generosity, our selfishness, our neediness, and our sense of dismissal of the pain of the deprived and hungry. But are we strong enough? Are we strong enough to know, first of all, that's how the mind is. That's what's going to happen. Are we strong enough not to be deterred by that? Not to have our glance deflected by that? And to work with what it is, why we become so contracted around our own needs and our fear response. To feel that, to begin to work with that as a workable way to come back into the field of generosity. For generosity is not a field in distant places. It's the field we walk upon when we release our selfishness. It's the open heart that's being barred by our fear. Our inward poverty, really, by our inward poverty, which is extremely prevalent in the West. Not external poverty, inward poverty, self-diminishment. It's interesting. It's interesting in a country where possessions are really the rule of the day, the rule of the culture, that our generosity is often around thing-giving, which is a very detached, disconnected way to give, isn't it, really? I mean, just let's look at it. Because you don't have to really be present. You give the sweater, Thank you very much for the sweater, Aunt Sue. And there, is there, I mean, much heart in that? Are there other ways for generosity to be authenticated? Besides, not that money and gifts don't have purpose and intention and don't support non-profit organizations and keep good works going. But if that's the limit of what we know generosity to be, then it's really a very disconnected form of relationship. Because at the heart, remember, at the heart of generosity is connection. Is feeling the pain, is connecting. Story I sometimes tell, not one I'm proud of. I was on a corner once with a very, on the same street corner, going in the opposite direction as I, across a different, was a homeless man, and I was waiting for the light to change so that I could get away from him. Because he smelled so bad. And so I was sitting there on the corner. We were both on the corner together. And I my light changed to my direction. So I started to go across, and he just grabs my arm a little bit. I thought, oh, God, what's this about? And it was about this time a few years ago, a little later, later in December, grabs my arm, and I whirl around, ready to confront the attack, and he says, well, Merry Christmas, he says. He said, Merry Christmas. You see? Now, first of all, you see, first thing that you have to confront is your own pain in that situation. And then you have, then through that, not denying it, not being coarse, one's own limitation. That's okay. You know, we all have that. We all get caught up in the fear response to life rather than to the generous response to life. And so, okay, we face that and we look at that. We look at the fear, and then you meet the eyes of the person wishing you well, and you feel the pain there. Now the heart even opens more. And then whatever connection occurs or doesn't occur from there. Because if you look at generosity beyond just thing-giving, then where is it that we could put some useful energy in this culture to really build the bridges of connectedness? Where can we change our world view from contraction to expansion? Because a generous heart is one that lives in abundance, regardless of wealth. See, a generous heart is not based upon how much we have. It's based upon the inward spirit of abundance. Inward abundance. And when we're contracted, we form boundaries. Boundaries around our generosity. You see, when we form boundaries, and they can be like concentric circles that strangle us, really. And where do we draw the boundary? Family? Self? Family? Anything outside of that is not included? How about country? Seems to me that that's a boundary that we're casting forth because of the fear level, building fences. And so where in the world do we cast, where is it that we limit the heart? When we do metta, it's for all beings. For all the hungry. some of the nonprofits, you know, Doctors Without Borders, Oxfam, that feeds the world's hunger. I don't look for exclusivity for this country. One of the things I used to do, and again, these are just little suggestions, they're not anything beyond that, is that I used to send my nieces and nephews, which were a considerable number, instead of trying to go out and buy things for them when they had plenty anyway, I would give them a gift in their name for Save Our Foundation that was like a goat was purchased in your name for somebody who lived in Guatemala or El Salvador or something. Hopefully, with the intent for them to look out beyond their own riches and not to begrudge the fact that Uncle Rod didn't give them anything this Christmas, which is always my fear. Where do we establish the borders? The blue states? Is that where our borders are? Is that it? I'm not living in those red states. Patriotism. See, until the principle of things take root, then patriotism will be our zeal. And when inside this border, where it seems to me that we're just dying from our own isolation, from our own sense of constriction and containment. So what are some of the ways that we could expand this field of generosity beyond thing giving? Well, how about the generosity of attention? Attention. When we give attention to someone, we're affirming them. Can you give a better gift than that? To affirm someone, to pay attention to them, you have to connect with them. You have to feel the relationship, which is true generosity of the heart. Validating them. When attention is paid, I am seen. I am seen. And in a world where not much seen is even taking place, how much noticing is really occurring? What we call quality time is really taking your son to the movies. Not seeing, not validating, not holding somebody in attention. I can't think of a more gracious gift than the gift of your understanding. For when we see, when we acknowledge, when we pay attention, then we understand the person. We let the person into our heart and we understand them. How about the gift of your time? How about spending time with someone? You see, that runs counter to the cultural imperative, which time is a commodity, the most precious commodity, the last thing that I'll give. That's what our social engagement component of SIMS is about. Going down and helping out at a homeless shelter, serving food, working at Northwest Harvest. The willingness to give up that precious commodity because I might waste it and I need to save it. It is precious. But not in the way we use it. What we mean by it being precious is it's productive time. It has to be productive. We have to have made something. We have to have increased something. We have to have something visually represented for our use of time. But really what time is sharing our aliveness. Huh? Sharing aliveness. And with that sense of time, where the time, we're not being pressured within time, so that we're offering time not under the gun of pressure, then that's patience. Have you ever spent time with somebody who's really patient? And isn't that like a blessing that you just can't believe, that they're there with you and there's no other thing that they're hurrying to go to? That the point of their being is to be with you. Isn't that an amazing gift? The gift of time. So many memories come back of my grandfather. There was no, when I was on his knee, I knew there was nowhere else he wanted to be. And I could feel that. And I don't know, maybe I was 2-3 years old. And the whole thing opened up. Because he wasn't listening to me for something. The whole thing opened up. And then you understand the origin of contentment. And you also see that generosity can only come from contentment. How about the gift of space? So that when we're with someone, we are not telling them or commanding them, but just giving them space to be authentic, to let their voice be heard, to let their voice come through. That's the gift of their own creativity, of their own authentic being. And it provides an enormous sense of safety. When we're there without demands, when we're there without judgment, we create that space for authentic living. And then we begin to see that the origin of growth is not through coercion, force by someone else to grow. It comes when we feel safe, when we are given space, when we are given attention, and we're given time. From that display come the willingness for one to explore one's own world within the safety of another's attention, within the spaciousness of non-judgment. In fact, it's the source of growth. The sacred made manifest is generosity. And as you begin to practice, you begin to feel that. You begin to feel, we begin to feel the connection. And you want to give back. You want to return. You don't want to just be the recipient all the time of other people's whatever. It just doesn't feel balanced. And you look for opportunities to give back. You just can't remain, especially when we realize our own privileged position on this earth. It's not a should. If it comes from a should, I would rather it not be done. It comes from a flow back. It's the tide flows up, it feels full, abundant, and it flows back out into the ocean. It's in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Suzuki Roshi talks about a stream that passed in front of their monastery. And he said that the monks would go down there with a dipper, and they would scoop out a dipper full, and they would drink half. And then they would throw the other half back into the water. And he says, you will not understand until you practice why the other half goes back into the water. Because it has to. Not intellectually. Not from the science of thirst. But from the abundance of heart. I was reading a story about a policeman who was on the Golden Gate Bridge just as someone was about to jump. And he got out of his police car, and the person jumped off just as he grabbed him. And he, the policeman, was almost pulled off with the person trying to commit suicide. And he was honored because it almost cost him his life, and he did save the other person. And he was asked by the press how he could have acted not within his own benefit. I mean, he wasn't even considering himself. And he said, I could not have lived with myself had I let that man jump without trying. His growth, when we embrace generosity, when we take it on and we say, okay, this is a path in and of itself, we can fold everything into that word. We can set the intention in our life. Let me learn about generosity, which means you will learn about your selfishness. Let me learn how to embrace this word, how to move with this word. May I be the most generous person. None of that. I just want to learn this word. I want this word to fill me. And then we start seeing. We start seeing through our actions. We start sensing something that comes alive through that intention. Something that resonates very deeply, which is the foundation in the crescendo of the choir. And we know why we're practicing. We know why we're here. We don't say, what am I doing this for? What's this all about? Which you will if you get lost in the root of the mind, because you won't feel it. You just feel the billiard ball of your separation. But there's no question. when you move with the path of the heart, why we're doing what we're doing. And may all beings know that when the truth of things take root, may all of us have a very thankful Thanksgiving. Can we sit for just a minute or two? Questions? If anyone has any questions about any aspect of this, we can. Oh, right. So, right. Yes, and we went to see Michael Mead, and he told the story, fantastic myth drummer, mythological. But the story was about a woman, very, very, very briefly, a woman who was living with somebody who was enraged from battle, and she was being quite likely abused within this relationship, and she went to seek professional consultation for a potion that she could give her lover so that he would calm down. And the wise man said, "You have to bring me a whisker from a tiger, a live tiger, and I'll make you that potion." And so she, through a bunch of trials and tribulations, clips off the whisker of a live tiger and brings it back to the wise man. And the wise man just throws it in the fire. And she says, "How could you do that? I've spent." He says, "Because you've already proved you have the courage now to face him." And so just that sense that there's much more in us than we look for ways to handle situations external to what we already hold, to what already we have. We look for generosity in places where we're not. So let's look for places where we are, where we're living, where we actually hold the thread of our aliveness. And to work that thread of our aliveness courageously into the pain of the world is really the art and journey of the meditation and the path of cultivating generosity as well. Yes. Yes.
To kind of move from the heart.
Yes.
And I've been thinking about leisure time, and I'm just curious if you could talk about what you mean by leisure time.
Question is about leisure time and how leisure time helps facilitate access to the heart. I think that's really what Thanksgiving was meant to be. It was a pause. It was to say, okay, wait a second here, you know. It's the end of fall. I mean, I'm translating it in my own way. And there's abundance here. Let's pause. Not just keep working endlessly here. Let's pause and see what all this work has been about. Let's pause and get back together here and see the connection that this work is meant to ripen and enrich. And sitting down with each other. And I think that what I meant by leisure time is the willingness to pause, the willingness to give yourself the benefit of your own generosity by giving yourself the benefit of some time to reflect, to be able to hold or to ask pertinent questions of your life, to see whether your life is being, both in terms of questions, if your life is being lived in accordance to the journey you most want, but to be able to examine the way life is being held in each moment. And so really, in the beginning especially, it requires time outside of normal interaction. And in Buddhism, they talk about renunciation, and you know, and as a monk, that's what you really do, is you give up entertainment and you give up all the normal ways that we distract ourselves, television and all of that, and you use the time for time self-reflected. I don't think we need to become monks and nuns, but I do think that we need time in which the normal distractions of our life are not imploding upon us, so that we can determine our balance, determine our posture, to look and to examine, to ask questions, ongoing questions that are extremely important. And for most people, they spend that time on vacation where they're doing more of the very distractions that keep them from those questions. My question is there a way for us to live our life not disengaged, but be fully engaged with those questions on our lips? There is something you have to give up in order to do that. You have to give up self-validation. To self-examine, you can't constantly be self-validating. And so there has to be a deep sense in each of us that the questions need to come not according to the cultural imperatives, but according to our heart's deep felt need to know and to understand ourselves. And when that urge is felt, then the time will be there. I have found that to be extraordinarily true, and I don't mean at all to be Pollyannish about it, but as the urge grows in each one of us, then the time allotted for the maturation of that view is also accompanies the urge, so that the universe gives forth the time for the very exploration of the journey in whatever way, in whatever engaged way that can be done. You know, suddenly I just have seen it in my own life. And so the work, the universe, when that urge is such, works cooperatively towards towards the enrichment of that understanding. And so that's really what I mean by leisure time. Yes.
Mm-hmm. How would you suggest to deal with fear that makes it difficult to make a connection with disadvantage and suffering?
So you have to say that a little louder, I think.
How would you suggest to deal
with the fear? Yeah. Right. How would you? How would I suggest working with the fear that sends you the opposite way towards the disadvantaged? Right. That has you right distance yourself from. Well, first you have to see that problem. First, you have to understand that that you're afraid of, for whatever reason, the situation that they're in. If they're homeless, you're afraid of the potential of you being homeless, or the possibility of, if you looked them in the eyes, here's another fear. You might be afraid that if you looked in them in their eyes and you really made genuine connection, you might have to take them home. Right? So that's another fear. I go, my God, what am I going to do if I really make connection with this person? A lot of that is just, you know, the mind's hyperbole. What you begin to do is you don't see the homeless. You see the human being, and you see the condition that surrounds the human being. You have to be willing to go through the fear to make the connection of equality. If you stay at the level of homelessness, then you stay at the level of pity. If you connect with the person's humanity, then you're connecting through your fear. The fear is no longer, is not around the humanity. It's around the outside trapping of the humanity. And so first, feel the fear of the outside trapping, and then see if you can't, when you give the dollar for real change, look the person in the eye. It's a human being, not a condition that you're serving. To me, as soon as I make that contact, then the resolution of the heart is there. The connection is there. That's the real giving. The dollar was a way to do it. And so you have to be willing to, as in any journey, you have to be willing to go through the fear of the context, and to look at the real points in which the fear are, you know, is this true? Am I afraid of being homeless? And okay, what, you know, I grew up poor and I just can't bear I don't know. I look at that history. Okay, I can work with that. And as you hold the fear, then you're going to come into the human connection that invites something far richer. Other questions or comments? Yes.
So the same holds true if we're trying to somewhere choose out the battle things incredibly differently than we do.
Does the same hold true for someone who thinks very, very differently than you do? Yes, like a red state. Somebody from a red state. Or a blue state, depending on how you voted. Yes. Yes, it holds true. Because their expression is often around their pain. And if you get lost in the expression, then you're going to miss the pain that's driving the expression. If you miss the pain, you'll never connect with in any compassionate or fulfilling way. Because the expression is just the expression. It's their opinion against yours. And their opinion is always going to be different than yours. And if you go far enough, you know, you'll find some part of that opinion that differs from you.
But isn't it kind of self-righteousness to assume that if they're like that, it's because they're in pain?
Almost all opinions come from pain. I could almost say all opinions come from pain, but I haven't scanned it enough in my own to say that. But I cannot think of a single opinion that doesn't come from pain. Because you see, when you begin to understand how the mind works, it forms itself around something as a conclusion to make it secure for me, because it's so difficult for it to be unsecure. So an opinion or a view is really a consolidation so that the righteousness of my own way and my judgment can be positive about myself. And that I would know, you see, all of that just kind of, it's all around self-validation. Well, you see, if you try to find meaning in where they find meaning, which is in their opinions, I don't think you're going to go very far in that. You have to go deeper than the opinion. You have to go to the neediness that creates the. I mean, can't you feel? I can feel it when you hear. What's an example of it? The religious right. That's fear. There's no question in my mind that that's fear that's leading to that kind of projected morality. Well, okay, so are we going to stop with the morality, or are we going to go through to the fear where that's really... You see, then you... Okay. Okay, so there's a human being afraid. So now there's a human being afraid in front of you, not a religious evangelical. Now, that's a very different kind of posture to take with somebody. You don't have to defend when somebody's afraid. In fact, what they need more than anything, right, is connection. So I just think that's the way to go. Yes.
It's seeming to me that the difference, a really important thing that makes a difference about whether when I see that person's pain and I respond to that, whether it's pity or compassion depends on whether I'm in touch with my own neediness and my own pain.
Right, exactly.
The way my own opinions are.
Right.
Are the result of pain. So
right. Right.
You know, it would be easy to sit here
right.
and be righteous and
that's
hard
right.
for you.
That's right. That's right. The point was that you're never going to be able to touch somebody else's pain of their fear until we have touched our own, until we have journeyed and the willingness to journey, because it's the issues that, it's the same process inwardly as outwardly. We have all these issues that keep the pain of our fear from us. And we hold the issues as a defense against the fear. And if we're not willing to look at the fear that drives the issues, then the issues will be the outstanding relevance of our life, not healing to the fear. And to heal to the fear is to heal myself into wholeness. Because once I can touch the fear, it can then embrace it as a part of my life, not let it drive me from my life through the issues. When the issue becomes important, I'm being driven away from my life, away from the very aliveness that the fear represents and holds for me. It's energetically, it's a part of the whole system. Fear energy, love energy are both energies. Both have to be embraced. So that's a very good point. Okay, so maybe we'll thank you all.